Welcome to the Industrialise podcast, where we speak to those leading the charge towards the future of construction. This week, Darren Richards, Director of Cogent Consulting, speaks to Jamie Johnston, Director and Head of Global Systems at Bryden Wood. In this conversation, Jamie talks about the ever-changed language surrounding industrialised construction, the efficiency gains of platform systems, and the mindset of the UK versus the rest of the world.
Welcome to the Industrialised podcast, where we're joined today by Jamie Johnston, the MBE from Bryden Wood. Welcome, Jamie.
Hello there, and thanks for asking me to join.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Jamie, and the work that you do at Bryden Wood.
So Bryden Wood, we are a global strategy and design consultancy. We've been around for 30 years this year, actually, and we have majored on typically working with serial clients, often in kind of more complex industries, so data centres, pharmaceuticals, healthcare, a lot of work with government, and trying to take clients on this journey from sort of project-based, you know, single project delivery into a more sort of product-based mindset. I think we were early adopters of design for manufacturing assembly, started out doing stuff for BAA as they were at the airports, was a sort of training ground for a lot of these things, and we've over time developed a range of different versions of this, but it's all sort of typically on the basis of trying to, you know, reduce cost, time, improve quality, those sorts of things for major clients.
And started out very much as an architectural practice, but I don't think you really describe yourself as an architectural practice anymore.
No, that's true. So we started out as architects with a particular interest in improving project delivery. We recognised actually one of the biggest things that needed addressing was the kind of lack of integration. So you assemble a project team and you have a range of different disciplines focused on one aspect of a project. We recognised that some of the biggest, easiest benefits were just in really integrating, you know, structure, mechanical, electrical systems. So, you know, if you look inside any product, there's no empty space left. Everything's been very compressed. If you look inside the ceiling void of a building, you know, there's the structural zone, pipework zone, cable tray zone. There's an awful lot of wasted space potentially, and one of the obvious things you can do is start to compress those things. And if you want to pre-assemble things, pre-manufacture things, then they start to look more like products, and you need to get into that sort of integrated mindset.
No, it's great. I think you've carved, you know, a very strong niche, you know, and a lot of companies look up to what Bryden Wood do as a practice. I think you've been very much in that kind of leadership position for many years now, so, you know, congratulations for that. I'm sure it's a very exciting position to be in. So we're here today to talk about industrialized construction, and just wanted to start really by getting your definition of industrialized construction, not necessarily in a single sentence, but more broadly, how you perceive industrialized construction and how you communicate what you mean by industrialized construction to your clients.
Yeah, it's a definitely worthwhile clarifying questions. I think this whole topic is sort of mired in confusion. So terms like modern methods construction, offsite, prefabrication, DFMA, design for manufacturing assembly, get interchangeably used, and they're not quite the same thing. Our definition of industrialized construction is more of a mindset. So I think people think about industrialization and manufacturing, and they automatically think of, you know, conveyor belts and robots and these sorts of things. We've tried to get closer to the kind of original principles. So, for instance, one of the things that manufacturing has done incredibly well is relentlessly focus on eliminating waste. And a lot of the benefits and the kind of cost reductions, improvements we've seen have simply been by streamlining processes, removing material, optimizing components. So that idea of really trying to apply lean principles, if you want to call it that, and sort of focusing on eliminating waste, there's massive gains to be had there. And that automatically takes you into a route of, you know, less material, less labor, increased productivity. So that has been a big focus of ours, to identify and optimize things, and hence the kind of integration is a powerful part of that. Another thing that we are particularly interested in that manufacturing has done well is moving away from sort of trade-based, craft-based work, trying to lower the barriers to entry by turning things into more simple, more highly repeatable processes. And again, that was one of the big things manufacturing did back in the day, was shift from everything being sort of trade-based, crafts-based thing into a series of simple steps that you could train people to do. So we've looked at this in all sorts of sectors and trying to move away from that sort of, you know, create components that can be configured and assembled in a particular way gives you all sorts of benefits, on-site and off-site. One of the big sort of looming things that the industry needs to address, obviously, the skills crisis. The CITB published a report saying just to maintain capability in the industry, we need 250,000 more people entering the industry. People aren't coming into construction. It's not seen as attractive to, you know, the next generation. So you can't backfill that, we think, by employing more bricklayers and things. That's not going to work. Our view is the way you tackle that is by diversifying the people that come into construction. So we've developed systems where we did a thing for GlaxoSmithKline where a pharmaceutical plant was assembled by ex-Gurkhas, ex-British Army. We've done prototyping with the Ministry of Justice where we were using serving prisoners to manufacture some of the components, which people thought was strange at the time, but were saying, imagine that your workforce suddenly becomes massively diversified. It's ex-services, it's ex-prisoners, it's serving prisoners, it's unemployed people who wouldn't consider construction as a job. But if you turned projects into configurable components that could be manufactured at scale, you'd create a whole load of new manufacturing opportunities, you'd create new jobs, you'd tackle the skills gap, you'd tackle the aging demographic. Like, we have to make that transition. So those are some of the sort of key features of industrialized construction that we're trying to enable through the work that we do.
So you're thinking really like a manufacturer. You know, you're looking at process in the truest sense of the way a manufacturer would. So eliminating waste, you mentioned about lean, you know, lean processes, lean manufacturing, you know, the automotive industry, you know, and Toyota in particular with their world-class manufacturing toolkit obviously has pioneered a lot of that stuff over the last 50 years. I think construction's quite late to the table.
Yes.
And some of this new terminology doesn't necessarily resonate with the more traditionalists. I think we have some challenges around that. But there's definitely a shift towards the discussion of should we say productivity, because people understand that productivity has a direct correlation to money.
Yes.
And cost and inefficiency. So your mindset, which I think is a very interesting term, effectively is to look at things in a different way to a traditional procurement and design process, and to think differently, more like a manufacturer, towards design for manufacture and assembly, I presume.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, we like the term design for manufacturing assembly because it describes the process. And again, when people talk about, you know, MMC or volumetric modular or whatever, they're often talking about the product or the outcome. We like the process of, if you want to manufacture and assemble something, you have to design it in a particular way to enable you to do that. So sometimes people try and retrofit modularization or, you know, some form of MMC, if you want to call it that, to an existing, a traditionally designed project, and there's always either a compromise in the design or a compromise in the system. If you want to, you know, manufacture assembly, you start from the outset with that as a first intent, and you work in a very particular way that enables that outcome. So we like the term because that's how we approach things. We are designing for manufacturing assembly.
And you've augmented that slightly with the PDFMA, the Platform Design for Manufacturing Assembly, and some of
yes.
the other extensions, I think, of that, which is quite an interesting move. So what would you consider to be your best practice examples? You mentioned about the GSK, the GlaxoSmithKline, which I know was an early pioneer. What do you think is the best example of DFMA and industrialized construction in practice on a project you've actually been involved in and delivered?
The thing that we've talked an awful lot about this project, people might be bored of hearing us talk about it, but the Forge, a project we did for Landsec, the office, that was the first project that used, as you say, PDFMA. So if I just explain PDFMA, one of the things we have seen that we've learned working from some very big clients, the BAA data center clients, you know, pharmaceutical clients and things, no individual client has a big enough program or pipeline of work to really shift the needle on the industry. When we started work with UK government, I was part of the BIM task group back in 2012. That was our sort of entry into public sector work. We started saying to government, look, you are the only client that has a long enough and persistent enough pipeline of work. So even the major programs, you know, schools programs, healthcare programs are relatively short-lived, you know, big burst of activity and then, you know, move on to a different sector. But so if you looked across the government estate, you are the only client that consistently spends tens of billions of pounds a year has a long-term interest in the assets, because you're building schools to educate the nation, you're building hospitals to improve the health of the nation and things. You're the only people that can do this. That sector focus, the fact that people procure projects project by project, means that you never get the opportunity for continued improvement and the things manufacturing does. The sector focus means that you're kind of bounded by a particular, you know, set of boundaries. We said, whereas lots of people focus on why sectors are different, if you turn the lens around and said, why are sectors the same, you would get a completely different outcome. So lots of building types have a very similar, we would call it a typology. So, you know, apartment blocks and healthcare wards and classrooms all have about an 8 meter span central corridor, about an 8 meter span. Typologically, they're very similar. So we said to government, if you started looking for that commonality, you could probably find some solutions that could be used across sectors. That's how you suddenly break the pipeline problem or the sector problem and suddenly get into the kind of the sorts of numbers that manufacturing is working to, the sorts of economies of scale that, that manufacturers work to. That's how you start to, you know, get the persistence of pipeline and consistency of solutions and all of those sorts of things. So we started doing some studies and found that there was massive commonality between a lot of the government assets, particularly around superstructure. And we said there's a kind of superstructure typology that suits about 70%, you know, those building types that I've talked about of the pipeline. That would be a phenomenal starting point. So we actually worked that through with Ministry of Justice, developed a whole series of solutions for them. Landsec literally took a superstructure concept or an idea we developed for prisons, extended its functionality to get the longer spans that commercial office uses, took all of the learning that we'd already got from the prototyping with the MOJ and things, like tweaked it, and suddenly Landsec, biggest private sector developer, are delivering a project which I think must be one of the most, certainly our most award-winning project, commercial office in London, and it demonstrated some incredible benefits, a 40% nearly reduction in carbon, massive productivity gains, massive increase in quality, much more like manufacturing. So I thought that was a brilliant example of something that government, only government really could do, to initiate. Private sector almost instantly saw the benefit and delivered it, and that project has been a huge success for us. And you could imagine, if you then multiply those benefits by the scale of the public pipeline, you go, right, now we're talking. Now, if you could take 40% of the carbon out of asset delivery across the public sector pipeline, that's massive. So it was, on its own, it was a kind of, I think, very good proof of concept, and the potential to then scale it up is has already been proven at the sort of government level.
It's an interesting one, because we've actually got Neil Pennell from Landsec speaking at the Industrialised Construction Conference in July, really to give, you know, a client's perspective on it, because I think we often talk, you know, about the delivery mechanism and the technology and, you know, that end of it, because we are technical people. So, you know, it'd be interesting to hear what the client's true benefits are, you know, in terms of that delivery process, you know, in terms of speed, quality, time, etc. You know, so
yes.
So looking forward to that really in the next month or so.
But also Neil will talk about what the client had to do differently. So that's one of the things maybe we'll talk about later, is it's not enough just to have a technical solution that works. You have to be able to procure it and find a supply chain and do all these things. So Landsec actually, yeah, Neil will talk about the attitude that Landsec had to have to make that work.
Yes, and that's the culture and the mindset stuff that you were talking about at you know, the beginning of this conversation. So you need to have well-educated, open-minded clients, really, I think, you know, to achieve and do some of the things that you do. And obviously you're dealing with government departments in a lot of instances. So when you think about how the supply chain rises to the challenge, so you're designing these new concepts, you're looking at platform design, you've got a DFMA approach that obviously would resonate very well with the supply chain. But how does the supply chain typically respond when you go out with this new way of thinking? Do they look at it and go, well, this is rocket science, this is just so far advanced? Or do they say, thank God we've got somebody that thinks like we do?
It's definitely more of the latter. So we have found, if you go down into the supply chain, there's actually quite a lot that has already been industrialised. So the facade supply chain, utilised facades have been, you know, manufactured at industrial scale for a long time. They're already there. Obviously, a lot of MEP now is increasingly prefabricated, so plant rooms, package plant rooms, distribution, these things. Virtually all, a large amount of the internal fit-out has already been systemised. So, you know, ceiling systems, wall systems, internal partition systems. So actually, in the supply chain, a lot of it has already been done. One of our biggest learnings was that the problem is the interface always between those bits that are already manufactured and the bits that aren't. So I'll give you the best example we often use is the facade supply chain told us that when they arrive on a typical construction site, 40% of their time is in site surveys, measuring, shimming, masticking, bracketing, like filling in the gaps between their millimeter perfect manufactured thing and the traditional, you know, superstructure that's they're attaching to. And so that was a kind of big insight for us, that a lot of the problems of the trades, the later trades, is fixing the tolerance problems of the trade before them. So it's why I mentioned superstructure earlier. The thing that automotive, or one of the things that automotive has done very well, is they make the chassis, it is sub-millimeter perfect, and everything else clips to it. It's the setting out for everything. So we put a lot of effort into making a very highly accurate superstructure that pre-enabled the trades that followed to do their best work. So we pre-installed some of the brackets for the superstructure. We pre-installed the fixing points for the MEP. And once, certainly on the forge, those supply chain partners came up with the prototype. They said, "Oh, exactly on your point, finally someone's pre-enabling me to do my best work." So we got a massive reduction in the facade cost simply because the manufacturers said, right, I know that this will work. I understand how I can install my things. They were, industry average is 7 facade panels a day. They were doing one every 6 minutes at peak because we'd pre-enabled them to do that. NG Bailey, who are the MEP partners on the forge, again, said, "Oh, finally, someone's setting up to, you know, allow me to do the thing I want to do." And so they were able to gear their Bradford facility to making things that would slot very neatly in between the superstructure. And again, you know, we got dramatic. We took about 30,000 hours off-site. All of the fixing holes were pre-engineered. So actually, the supply chains are ready for this if you kind of enable them to do their best work. And actually, on the MEP for the forge, we did the design to a certain point, handed it over to Bailey's and said, sort of finish off the design in a way that best suits your facility, best suits your method of install. You know, we've taken it so far, now you can finish it. And they had loads of ideas about how to optimize things, how to simplify or streamline the design. So again, our experience has been that, you know, the supply chain is ready for this, but someone at the higher level needs to kind of set the tone and make these things work and integrate design, coordinate the design to allow these parties to work together. So putting the superstructure up on the forge was, you know, we were obsessive about the tolerances. On 9 meter bays, we were plus or minus 5 millimeters, which is not normal construction tolerances. And that was a challenge. But we kept saying to the superstructure team, honestly, the trains that follow will love this. And that, again, was a big insight for us, getting one team to do some hard yards for the benefit of the following teams. That's not a normal construction mindset, but it's definitely a manufacturing mindset. They're always doing these deals and saying, well, can I borrow some weight for the engine to make the chassis stiffer or vice versa? So brokering those sorts of things and saying one team is going to work really hard so every other team has a more simple time. That's much more manufacturing mindset than construction.
It's impressive. I mean, what you talk about with those tolerances, and, you know, again, engaging with the right supply chain partners that have the right mentality is important as well, isn't it? You know, because I think we've all seen adaptations and uninformed changes to buildings as they're being put together, you know, and the loss of control, if you like, of that assembly process, because it's really not an assembly process in a traditional method, is it? You know, you've got tradesmen who are adapting and modifying each other's work in an uninformed,
yes,
and sometimes an unauthorized capacity.
Yes, oh, definitely, yeah, yeah, very much so, yeah.
Okay, good. So you've mentioned several UK-based examples of work there, but I know you've done quite a bit of work internationally over the last couple of years. Where have you seen different approaches to industrialised construction, or where have you seen in the world that is potentially better than what we do in the UK? What's best practice look like globally, or are we best practice in the UK?
I think the thinking in the UK is probably more advanced. Certainly around these, you see the sort of government interest in platforms, particularly in that sort of trying to influence the industry. I think the thinking's advanced. I think we could easily get overtaken. So we're currently doing lots of work in the US with data center clients. And you can imagine those clients have large pipelines, lots of funds, massive demand, you know, a real impetus to do things better. And so that's driving a lot of the innovation, I think, that's happening. And there's also, we're currently working on, there's a lot of, we call it new technology. So there's a load of things coming out of the carbon capture, energy transition, you know, decarbonizing pharmaceuticals, those sorts of arenas where there is a need to move very, very quickly from sort of pilot scale into mass deployment. So we're seeing technologies now where they will skip over what would normally be a typical project. And they're saying, if I've got this new technology, if it's to have any impact, I'm not going to do one or two deployments. I need to do hundreds, sometimes thousands of deployments. I haven't got time to go through the normal learning cycle of building things traditionally. So they're skipping over projects and going straight into products. And I think that will drive a lot of this, because we'll start to see how you can really deploy, you know, some of these technologies, they're not, you know, they're not widgets. They're quite big facilities in their own right. Deploying those at scale, I think, will accelerate a lot of these kind of techniques we would need. And the data center arena, someone, one of our clients mentioned recently that the change to AI and the kind of densities that's needing, and the change to liquid cooling and things, it's not quite a reboot, but it's resetting a lot of knowledge, or people are having to learn things very quickly in the data center space. And that, combined with the time imperative and the money available, means that I think that arena will start to move very quickly. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if the US funds a bunch of things. I mean, yeah, obviously, political situation aside at the moment, be interesting to see what happens in the US in a few years. I think that could fast track a lot of this, because it's such a big market with a whole load of very well funded serial clients. Asia's the other place, obviously, that some of this stuff happens. So in certainly in Japan, the delivery of some of their residential systems, they've been doing that very well for years. They've already cracked some of these things. And again, I'm sure everyone's seen examples of this where, you know, buying your house is a lot like buying the car, that you go in and you choose from your finishes and you choose your dimensions and you get that kind of level of mass customization. So they've done it in residential. I think if you could start to apply that to other sectors, again, I think if we're not careful, the UK will have done some really clever thinking that gets deployed and gets picked up by other nations, which has happened to the, you know, which has happened before.
And I think, you know, your Japan example is an excellent one. I first went out to see several modular manufacturers doing housing in Japan in 1997, 98, 99, you know, so you're going back a long time, you know, and they were way ahead of the game then, and they've maintained that distance, I think. You know, they're constantly re-engineering processes and products and, you know, looking at continual improvement, and those kind of manufacturing mindset is prevalent everywhere, I think. I think the danger of us being left behind is it down to the fact that we're too cautious, we're not ambitious enough, or is it purely down to the fact that the pipeline is just not there, the need for speed is just not there yet?
I think one of the things that's getting in the way, there's a lag between doing the thinking and actually, I mentioned this earlier, being able to procure it. So one of the things we ran into on some of our public sector things is that the existing construction frameworks weren't set up to do this. And so there's a legacy of frameworks and contract types and things that are very much geared to deliver the thing that we've always done. So that is a bit of a blocker. That some of the big questions I think that need to be addressed are not the technical things. I think everyone believes it can be done, and I think there's enough evidence now of the benefits of doing this, but the big questions are around, you know, contract types and procurement frameworks, and IP still seems to be a question people are sort of wondering what happens to IP, what happens to designers, what happens to the, you know, the the shift in people's sort of job titles, descriptions and things. So I think it's that cultural thing, again, it's the mindset. The cultural thing needs to change, and that needs some proper consideration. And I think that was one of the, where we sort of left the government saying, look, you know that technically this can happen, but you would have to change the way you procure things. You'd have to address these things. You'd have to start to get over some of these cultural hurdles to allow people to do this and feel comfortable that they would be suitably incentivized to work in this new way of working. I think, you know, the financial models and the business models haven't caught up with this yet.
I think it will catch up. I think we're hearing some very good phrases, announcement, pledges, whatever you want to call them, coming out of the new NISTA organization, and that whole national infrastructure initiative, I think, could be the leader, you know, the real kind of driving force behind this, because obviously the ripple effect then into other sectors and the influence it will have on other government departments could be quite significant.
Yes.
So I think there's quite an exciting period coming around infrastructure development, the 10-year infrastructure plan or infrastructure strategy, which I think is due out in mid-June, straight after the spending review. You know, that could be the real catalyst to accelerate this and to change some of those procurement models. So it's quite an exciting time, really.
Yes, so I think all of that, yeah, I think that thinking has been already been done. So I think, yeah, NISTA will start to collate that and revisit some of the things that... So the old IPA, their Transforming Infrastructure roadmap, talked a lot about platforms, a lot of the benefits of platforms. I think there's programmes like the new hospitals programme where a lot of the talk that's been, we've seen from that, talking about kind of standardised reference design. We worked on some of the early versions of what they're calling Hospital 2.0. That, I think, is a huge opportunity to land this thinking. Again, I think some of the thinking has already been done. I think if you could prove out a lot of this stuff in building delivery through NHP, I think NISTA will start to tie a lot of this up through other social infrastructure, transport infrastructure. So, yeah, well, the conditions are absolutely there. You know, the desire, I think, is there. So, yeah, I think we'll be doing the same, watching with interest to see whether we can actually land this in the next 5-10 years.
I think the biggest challenge is whether the housing industry is going to move with the other vertical markets that we've just mentioned, you know, or whether housing is still going to be, you know, relatively speaking, lagging behind, you know, because it's a different model, isn't it?
Yes, and I think there's obviously been a number of technologies. People have tried to do volumetric housing over a number of years. That hasn't worked for various reasons. I'm interested to see whether that housing sort of as a sector therefore thinks, yeah, we tried this, didn't work for us, as you were, we'll continue. Again, I think there's a real focus on that sort of sector specialism, that people tend to think that housing is its own little world and that it's very, very hard to, it is very hard to influence, it's hard to break into it. But yeah, I'm hopeful that if you could prove it on some of the other sectors, you get, if we can build hospitals and schools and, you know, other social infrastructure like this, there's absolutely no reason you couldn't then apply this to housing. And some of our early studies, I mentioned right at the start, you know, the PDFMA typologies we were looking at, you know, the sorts of spans and loads and things in apartments are not dissimilar, not you know, single two-story houses, but certainly in apartment blocks, there's a massive level of overlap between that as a typology and, you know, schools, inpatient wards, those sorts of things. So yeah, there's definitely a way of cross-fertilizing learning from those sectors into housing if the housing sector is willing to accept it.
Well, I certainly think we've seen a shift towards industrialized construction thinking, the built-to-rent sector. I think if you slightly augment what the definition of the housing is into the purpose-built student accommodation market, that's, you know, really embraced standardisation and optimisation. Yes. And manufacturing process. So there is some residential industrialising of the process going on. I think the low-rise housing one is probably the last kind of bastion, I think, you know. And there are some encouraging signs. I think, you know, 5 of the top 10 house builders now have invested multiple tens of millions in their own manufacturing facilities. You know, that says they've now got skin in the game. So, you know, maybe we'll see something change, you know.
Yeah, and I think you're right about the build-to-rent sector. There was that report, Generation Rent, a while ago that said, you know, lots of people in the future will be long-term renters. There is, no one's really tackled this, but you could imagine someone slightly rethinking housing as a product and saying the next generation of renters might not necessarily come with the same kind of mental picture of what housing is like, and it could be much more product based, and it could be considered in a slightly different way. So I'll give you an example. I stayed in the thing, just as a stupid anecdote, I stayed at a hotel or an apartment with my wife and kids years ago in Helsinki, and you could see joints in the walls and in the ceiling. And I was saying to my wife, that's actually, those are precast. They haven't finished, they've literally just painted it. And it was completely acceptable to have joints in the way that you would in office partitions and things. But in a traditional house, you go, I want everything to be plastered and painted, and I don't want any joints, I don't want to see the thing. But you could imagine a thing where people live in a house and it's much more like a product, and it's much more, you know, you express the manufacturingness of it, and it feels different, and there's some flexibility and adaptability that you can do in products you can't do in normal housing, and there's a kind of potential ease of replacement of things, that you keep changing things and upgrading things. So you could think of housing as a very different thing that would lend itself to manufacturing and might lend itself to a kind of younger market. You're going, I don't want to live in a traditional house like my parents or grandparents. I want to live in a, you know, a product like a car or like a, you know, an aspirational type thing. So we haven't gone there. And again, that's a sort of cultural change. But there are some exciting opportunities for people that want to do it. I think Urban Splash had a good go at this. When you went in some of their units, you could see the kind of shadow. They expressed things as shadow gaps, but they were actually panel joints and things. And they made a feature out of it and said, yeah, I'm trying to get an architectural expression that represents the manufacturing nature. So, yeah, there's lots of opportunities if people want to think slightly differently.
And I think the Urban Splash proposition was interesting because they shifted the narrative from buying rooms to buying space, you know, and that whole kind of open plan adaptability thing. Obviously the end of that story wasn't great in terms of their manufacturing process, but, you know, that's probably, again, pipeline driven more than anything else. You know, these manufacturing facilities are hungry beasts. You know, once you create the, you know, and you get onto the treadmill, you've got to keep feeding the beast. And there are challenges, you know, that I think the housing sector will rise to in time. There are endemic cultural things that I just don't think will change for decades, but time will tell. Time will tell. So in terms of emerging construction technologies, and I include within this digital, not just manufactured product, what most excites you at the moment? What have you seen, whether it's within the data center space or whether it's within the commercial office space or even within the pharmaceuticals? What really kind of floats your boat and gets you excited in terms of a future technology, whether it's digital or physical?
I think in the digital space, certainly a number of our clients now are on this pathway to configurable pre-engineered designs. So they're saying, look, you know, most of my assets are quite similar. I could break them down into a digital library of standardized, repeatable components that I could use at different scales. And I could start, again, designing, rather than design things from scratch, I could configure things, I could do, you know, site test fits very quickly. I could develop the solution, the digital models and all the kind of the documentation very quickly. Those digital models would lend themselves to then being replicated as a physical pre-manufactured element. So that linking of the digital to physical, I think, is quite interesting. And that idea of using a load of a library of pre-engineered components and being able to move very quickly through the project life cycle from due diligence on a site, test fit of the site, design of the site, feeding information down to manufacturers, the potential is very much there to like really close that and dramatically increase the speed of delivery. And obviously that's why data center people are interested in this. So yeah, I think that sort of potential link to move very quickly and link digital to physical is quite interesting for us. And obviously part of the idea of platforms was you'd have a relatively small number of highly repeatable components. So in terms of your management of the models and version control and the ability to continually improve those components and start to drop in new products and get into a new product introduction type of workflow rather than a design everything from scratch workflow. I think there's massive opportunity there. I've yet to see someone do a proper And maybe they have, and I just haven't seen it. I've yet to see someone do a proper handover from the kind of as-built model into the digital twin and the kind of operational model. That, I think, is very near term, and that's coming, and you can see people starting to test the boundaries of that. But again, completely getting the digital life cycle from test fit through to operational digital twin, that would have enormous benefits. I think everyone understands those, but we haven't done that yet. I think that's coming fairly quickly.
I think that will come at pace, you know, probably because the building safety regulations, the Building Safety Act, you know, where you know, the management of that golden thread and that information and the surety of that information that you built it the way you said you built it, you know, is putting a lot of pressure on developers in particular, isn't it? And, you know, I think that is starting to focus people on understanding the link between the digital and the physical.
Yes. No, absolutely, absolutely, yeah. No, I think you're right. I think that will force people into learning how to do a number of things that, again, would have wider application back from housing into other sectors. Yeah, actually, yeah, that yeah, the golden thread, the digital sort of certainty. Yeah, why wouldn't we do that for every other asset type once we've learned how to do it well in housing?
And the interesting thing, you mentioned configurable designs, and, you know, other industries have had configurators, you know, automotive. I know people get sick to death of us kind of ramming automotive as an example down their throats when we're talking about construction. But, you know, these things work, you know, and that whole concept of invisible standardization, giving that customer that choice, you know, using configuration tools really intelligently, you know, to streamline the process and manage the information more effectively. Has been around for decades, and you know, we should be tapping into those sectors and learning from them.
Yes, so we spend a lot of time with our clients actually trying to ascertain where choice or variability adds benefit. So there's a real, I think, nervousness maybe from the design community that this idea of standard components and configurable spaces will mean sort of cookie cutter buildings, and it will mean the death of good design. We actually think the opposite. We think if you're going to use a thing multiple times, you can put more design effort into it than anyone could on a single project. So you can absolutely optimize things, you know, for the client at, you know, building space component level, and multiply the benefits of having done that. But actually, what some of our clients have said, look, I have a pattern book of standard designs. I know my product, I know my asset very well. I just want to deliver that, but as soon as a local team gets hold of it, they feel obliged to kind of tweak it for the local jurisdiction and say, actually, I've got a slightly better idea for this. And you start to get uncontrolled variation away from the kind of the template reference design, but not necessarily adding benefit to the client. So obviously designers want to add benefit, they want to add value with their design, but actually often that's at odds with what the client wants, which is just my, you know, my standard repeatable thing. So we spend a lot of time with clients talking about, we call them choice points, and saying, where do you want variability and customization or even total bespokeness? Where does it add value because it's part of the, I don't know, user experience or the public expression of your building or asset? Where doesn't it add value because it's back of house or it's, you know, a functional space that needs to do something very well? So teasing that out of people and saying, yes, you should have a level of variance and bespokeness, but only where it adds value and only where it's most beneficial to a client. Actually, a lot of it you can standardize without compromising or even with enhancing the kind of efficiency of an asset. That's always a really interesting tension, but it's out of the back of that you then start to go, so which bit should be the kind of template configurable components, which bit should be more variable, and you start to do that but in a much more structured way. And actually that is enormously beneficial. We would do that as a precursor to ever trying to develop a sort of design automation workflow. Often the value is in that front end piece of just teasing out of people you know, their domain expertise, their subject matter expertise, putting it into a format that, you know, there's often a whole load of best practices in people's heads, but it's not written down. Actually getting people to write it down, saying, when is it a rule and when is it a, we always do this except when we don't, and bringing that transparency to how assets go together, that has enormous benefits. And it's a sort of precursor then saying, right, now I could start to understand the, you know, the repeatable bits, now I could start to understand levels of configurability, now I could start to understand the components and all these things. So yeah, putting that effort in at the front end actually is a very sort of interesting creative activity. It helps clients enormously as a kind of value add, and I think that's the sort of thing we should be focusing on.
And that facilitation process, which obviously you're offering as a service, you know, allows you to get inside the mind of the client as well, the culture of the client, doesn't it?
Yes.
Because you have to understand, you know, that, you know, if you're doing something for Google, it's going to be very different to, you know, XYZ, you know, because they've got a cultural approach to the way they do business, the way they treat their clients and their colleagues. And quite a challenge, I think, that facilitation piece, because you're trying to really get inside people's heads and extract every little bit of their thinking,
yes,
to document it and process it to enable you to get the brief right.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's a, we call it, we have an approach we call design to value, which is, you know, working ideally with the, yeah, the front end of projects with clients to say, don't tell me what the asset is. Or we sometimes say, you know, our best clients don't tell us what they want. They tell us what they need, and we'll work out actually what they want. But so a lot of the work, particularly in things like the pharmaceutical world, where we said, if you really understood the kind of the you know, the process that sits in the building, and you really optimize that, like the form of the building would reveal itself, the kit parts would reveal itself, but you just focus on, you know, you work from the inside out and focus on the thing which the client really wants, which is a, you know, a lean manufacturing process, making drugs or, you know, products or whatever it is. You go, if I just kept working that and I understood what was driving the client's business and their decisions, then yeah, I'd uncover a load of interesting things that the brief would kind of reveal itself. And that, yeah, that we think is a much more, yeah, rewarding for us and value adding for the client sort of process. And yeah, our best clients tend to be serial clients. So GlaxoSmithKline, I think we worked continuously with since 2007 or something. Most of our clients, when we started working with them, we like to continue working with them because, yeah, as you say, you start to understand how they work as a business, and that is, you can add a much greater value by really driving things at the front end. If you just take an asset and you slightly optimize it, then you can, you know, you can add a, you can certainly add some benefit, but understanding a client's business drivers and really working at the front end, that is a huge value. And bringing it back to industrialized construction, again, that's what sort of Toyota famously did. They said, we are customer centric. You just focus on what the customer wants, and it will reveal everything that you would need to do in service. That we have the same mindset. You focus on what's valuable to a client, and yeah, becomes more apparent what you should do in design of their assets.
I think the big challenge is working with the right type of clients, because not all clients in the or customers of the construction industry would have the right mindset, would they? So I guess you have to be relatively selective in the types of clients you're working with. Yes, you need serial clients with big pipelines, but you also need those clients who really understand this model, because this is a completely different approach, isn't it?
Yes. So I think we've been lucky. It's a mixture of luck and sort of targeting clients, but yeah, we do have, I would say, a fantastic sort of roster of clients. They certainly. We get to a point where people start coming to us, and we started doing a thing a long time ago. There's a guy, John Dyson, who works with us now. He was our client at GSK. When we would get a potential client, we'd often get them to go for a coffee with John and say, "Don't if you ask us what we do, we'll give you a version of it." And we would say that. We go and talk to an existing client and see what he says about it. And that was very interesting, firstly, because obviously John talks like a client and understands what drives some of these clients. And also the fact that we're willing to let an existing client talk to a potential new client and go, well, that's quite interesting. I don't normally get to have that conversation. So we've had a few of these. Circle Health were one of the other clients that came and talked to John, and then we would get people to go and talk to Circle Health. So that's been useful, that we've kind of encouraged potential clients talk to new clients. We host these, we call them Accelerate events in our office. Now we had one recently. We had Pfizer, Roche, AstraZeneca, GSK, Sanofi in the office talking about the challenges of moving from traditional batch production into much more intense or continuous production. They're all on this journey now, saying, look, you're all facing this big industry challenge. There's no point you all moving at your own pace. If you shared some of your pain and problems, we kind of sit in the middle of this. You might accelerate that journey by talking to each other. So again, that's very unusual. We had one for data centers where we got a whole load of data center players who, even a few years ago, that would have been unthinkable, that you get data center competitors sitting in our office sharing some thoughts around big industry challenges. But that's the kind of space we're trying to create, and facilitate these conversations between potential customers as much for their benefit, or probably more for their benefit than our benefit. But again, trying to break down those silos and get people to talk and being the kind of collaborative facilitator, that is, I think, a big thing that we're doing at the moment. And it's allowing us to have these conversations and, as you say, sort of drive some of these things in a particular direction.
You know, it's a skill in its own right, isn't it? You know, it's part of this process, you know. So, you know, I think getting that collaborative culture is what, you know, brings those what would ordinarily be competitors together for the common good. And I think, you know, we need more of that in the industry. We're nearly out of time, but I wanted to just come to a final point. We've got this industrialized construction conference in July, the Manufacturing Technology Center, which you'll be speaking at, and you're on a panel, so it'll be interesting to see what we get from the audience. I suppose I'm trying to understand what it is you would say if you had policymakers, architects, contractors in that room, which is what the target audience is, senior level executives mainly. What's the one thing that you would advise them to do if they're going to go away from the Manufacturing Technology Centre the following day and implement an industrialised construction strategy?
I think this, so the policymakers, I think they've already, as I said, they've already done the thinking. I think they would, I think you should, they should revisit the where the IPA left off, the Transforming Infrastructure roadmap. I think there's some really interesting stuff in there that is, I think, is still relevant and could still inform policy. I think for designers and contractors, we hosted a thing a little recently for a mixed group of people, but there was something interesting that came out of it was saying, look, if you there's some basic things you can do to facilitate a sort of DFMA outcome. So things like, you know, just rationalising grids, or using very repeatable grids and, you know, floor-to-floor heights and things. If you designed towards a DFMA solution, you could always build it traditionally. Like, there's nothing that we would necessarily design into a DFMA thing that couldn't be done traditionally. But if you don't design it in a particular way, then you can't post-apply DFMA. So one of the things that we would encourage people to do is say, look, treat it as a destination, and you might not make it on the first project, but there's no risk in doing the things that you would do in terms of, you know, standardization and, you know, integration and all these things. And yeah, if the end result means that you can, you know, deliver it to kit of parts, then fantastic. If, even if you built it traditionally, there would still be benefits to the people on site going, well, that's handy because I'm always using the same, you know, base spacing, whatever it is. So thinking in those terms of, you know, tending towards a kind of manufactured outcome, it's no risk to you as a designer. It will have benefits to you as a contractor. It doesn't preclude any of the things that you would normally do, but it does open the doorway to some interesting things that, that are coming. So doing that now and sort of practicing that kind of discipline or mindset, you know, you can be limbering up now without any risk to yourselves, and but, you know, creating some capability that will have to become useful because we have to transform the industry in the next 5-10 years, or we can't possibly deliver enough stuff for enough people over the next sort of 20-30 years.
Good. I think that's a very sage advice. Listen, I think we could talk all day. We're out of time, unfortunately, so I'd like to thank you for your time. It's been a real pleasure to discuss your views on industrialized construction, and I'm sure we'll pick this up again. We definitely will pick this up again at the Industrialized Construction Conference in July. So appreciate your time. Thanks very much for your insights and for your knowledge and your wisdom.
No, thanks so much. That was an interesting chat. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Industrialized Podcast. This podcast was produced by Radar Media. The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Radar Media. If you enjoyed any of the themes discussed, then the Industrialized Construction Conference is the perfect place to hear more from the experts who are dedicated to the advancement of the construction industry. For more information, head to www.industrializedconstruction.co.uk.